All of the Fretboard Journal podcasts are brought to you by a few presenting sponsors. First up is Marden Guitars. Marden Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Then we have Carter Vintage Guitars over in Nashville, where guitar lovers go for a good time. And we have a brand new presenting sponsor, Calton Cases. Your custom instrument deserves a custom case. Thank you to all of our presenting sponsors. Welcome to a very special episode of the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Berlindi, the founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And for this episode and this episode alone, I am joined by my dear friend, author and guitar fanatic, John Stubbings, all the way from London, England. John and I first met when he attended the Fretboard Summit, which took place exactly 5 years ago this week. That weekend, that cold, magical, windswept weekend on the Northern California coast was a total blur for me. We had all of these incredible musicians, many of which were my guitar heroes. We had all of these world-class luthiers on site giving presentations. And honestly, I ran around like crazy trying to make sure everybody was happy and frantically pacing like some sort of demented wedding planner. But I heard others had fun, and I got to meet John, and he told me about a book he was writing, which was going to be a comprehensive history of the steel string acoustic guitar. It was going to look and feel like nothing else available, something for the true bibliophiles out there who love guitars. And it was going to have a unique, often hilarious spin on the modern guitar movement and what it means to have GAS, guitar acquisition syndrome. Needless to say, it piqued my interest. I was curious to see how it was going to unfold. And I'll be honest, I hear about a lot of great guitar ideas from readers and listeners all the time. It comes with the territory with this magazine and the podcast. Sometimes the ideas see the light of day. Sometimes I never hear from the person again. Sometimes the ideas fall flat. But last year, when this box from London came to my office and I opened it, I was floored. It's this massive slipcased book with original art inside of it called The Devil Is In It, a story of love, obsession, and the American acoustic guitar. I was speechless. I started diving into it. I started reading it. It was so informative. It was so interesting, his angle and how he approached this subject matter. And it's just page after page of fascinating facts and thoughts. It does not look like any other guitar book. It reminds me of the high-end, hand-bound letterpress books I used to collect and even print back in the day. Yes, I was a letterpress printer before the Fretboard Journal took over my life. John weaves tales from Marden and Orville Gibson and Lloyd Lore up through Bob Taylor and Richard Hoover of Santa Cruz and Jason Costell of Costell Guitars and so many other familiar names to anyone who reads this magazine. He also somehow was able to weave the music of the blues all the way up to Hank Marvin and the Beatles, Bob Dylan and David Rawlings, on and on. He stops at George Grunes, he stops at Eric Schoenberg's and various other places familiar to any Fretboard Journal reader. And he has all these personal tales of guitar collecting, which are hilarious. The book is filled with amazing illustrations from Fretboard Journal contributor Drew Christie. And the whole thing feels like the very reason I started the Fretboard Journal magazine 15 years ago, to create a keepsake product that won't ever get thrown away and that will endure like all these guitars we geek out on do. This is a limited edition book, and I think it's going to be like with those Samura coffee table books on guitars. After it sells out, they're going to sell for double and triple what they're selling for now. So John and I have been talking, and rather than do a dry interview about the book and how it came to be, all the stuff you can read about on his website, we're going to hear his beautifully British accented voice read from actual pages of the book. I thought it'd be fun for you to wrap your head around it. And the best part of all, John is letting any Fretboard Journal reader or podcast listener get a 50-pound discount if you do want to nab this book while it's available. You can use the discount code London when you check out on his site. It's worth it, folks. Trust me. This episode of the podcast is sponsored once again by Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire lineup of gig bags, studio monitor stands, pedal boards, and pedal board bags. They are the very best in the business. Also, Folkway Music, Canada's finest vintage and new acoustic store. It is owned by another Fretboard Summit alum, Mark Stutman, who's also been on this podcast a bunch. He is arguably the finest vintage Gibson flat top repair person alive today, and I'll stand by that. As always, I hope you'll subscribe to the Fretboard Journal itself in either print or discounted digital form. It helps support the show and all the fun stuff that we do. COVID be damned. We're still putting out podcasts and videos and online content like nobody's business. And we even have a couple of new podcasts brewing that I hope to publish, put out before the year is over. They're going to be fun and they're going to be different. Again, the name of the book you're hearing about today is The Devil Is In It. The author is John Stubbings. I'm including a link in the show notes. Use that discount code London, just like the city in England, and you're going to save £50 off the purchase price. This is not a cheap book. It is a true limited edition work of art. And if that speaks to you, I can guarantee you're going to love it. It's pretty much the perfect guitar geek gift ever. Thanks for tuning in, and now I am passing the proverbial microphone over to our friend across the pond, John Stubbings. I hope you enjoy it.
The Devil Is In It, a story of love, obsession, and the American acoustic guitar by John Stubbings. This book is a love story about the steel string flat top acoustic guitar, one that started when I was a teenager and one that endures as strongly as ever to this day. But as with lots of love stories, it inevitably describes a journey into obsession. I was waiting for the delivery of two new guitars, at the time my 14th and 15th, and I knew I had contracted an extreme and unreasonable enthusiasm for guitar acquisition. Before I inevitably acquired more, I needed to understand why and how this had happened. How had the 18th century European or Spanish guitar been transformed by the 20th century into the modern American steel string acoustic that had such a hold over me? In search of an answer, I'd read extensively around the topic, lots of books about guitars and their history, papers by academics and interviews with players, makers, collectors and dealers. As I dug deeper and ever wider, a friend said to me, "You've got to leave the books behind, and the telephone, and the internet. Just pack a bag and get out there." He suggested that I follow the guitar's own journey from Europe to America to better appreciate its strange energy to induce obsession and often addiction amongst guitarists and guitar builders alike. My journey and the people I met helped me explore the history behind the defining instrument of the 20th century. As I travelled from New York to Pennsylvania, through the Carolinas to Tennessee and Mississippi, and then from the Mexican border up through California, I learned how so much of the music culture we have today came from the poorest sections of the black and white communities of America. By the end, I understood how much of that music was inspired and facilitated by the steel string flat-topped acoustic, and most importantly, how the guitar had become the people's instrument. Introduction. Sometimes I have the most terrible dream that I die and my wife sells my guitars for what I told her I paid for them. The words are from a 2014 interview with Hank Marvin, lead guitarist with The Shadows, a British beat group immensely popular in England in the 60s. It's delivered as a gag, but it's also halfway to a confession. As if saying it in public, if saying it out loud, normalises what Marvin knows to be an unhealthy obsession that has led inevitably to him deceiving his partner. Every guitar acquirer I've spoken to in the course of researching this book know they have an addiction. And most addicts become adroit liars. I know, because I am that liar. Many of us will publicly admit to owning a few guitars, but gentle private interrogation reveals that a few often means more than a dozen, and very likely many more. A new guitar may have a home value of $1,000, but a purchase price several times that. Guitars that were traded to allegedly fund or make space for the new acquisition quietly reappear in the household. Talk to guitar dealers and they'll all tell you stories of strict instructions to ship guitars to a client's office, not their home. Of guitars bought and left in the store for months, just until the coast is clear and a bit easier. Of old empty guitar cases bought from home to smuggle back newly acquired treasure. One dealer in Georgia told me the story of a wealthy and recently widowed woman in Atlanta. She'd called her late husband's local guitar store to see if they were interested in acquiring his collection of six rare guitars. When they visited the home, They saw the six guitars, but knowing that he'd bought at least 30 from them, they asked if he had a storage area, a garage, a loft space, or an attic. An hour later, they were looking at a remarkable collection of over 80 vintage guitars stored at the back of the attic. Although a successful, confident businessman who could easily afford the couple of million dollars they were worth, why did he choose to hide how many he had and how great their value? Shyness to admit his passion, perhaps? Or guilt at his obsession? We might not understand his motivations or reasoning, but we do know that he was a serial acquirer and a guitar geek. During my own road trips across America, I heard multiple versions of the very different stories that permeate the guitar world. Divining myth from fiction and untangling long-accepted facts from truth became a journey of discovery in itself. Revered guitar legends like Lloyd Law, feted by Gibsonites, turned out to be a man who nearly drove the business to bankruptcy. Absurd multiple claims of ownership of a long-past country legend's unique, one and only Martin D28. A Frankenstein guitar sold by a big-name dealer to an equally big-name performer that had been ricocheting unchallenged around the music industry for decades. During the course of thousands of road miles and 5 years of conversations, I was sworn to secrecy over the true price or actual provenance of an instrument more times than I can remember. But during my travels and those many conversations, I discovered the allure, power, and incalculable influence of the guitar on music, society, and the individual. I began to understand how the extraordinary, at times almost accidental, development of this once little respected instrument completely reshaped 20th century music. I saw how it became the defining instrument of our age, democratizing music making over a dozen decades and influencing the popular culture and music of our time. I learned how the guitar doesn't just provide a musical accompaniment to the social and political history of both Britain and the USA, but is often at its very heart. Chapter 1. Oxford Town, Oxford Town, everybody's got their heads bowed down. The sun don't shine above the ground, ain't a going down to Oxford Town. To start at the middle. It's almost 6 p.m. on a late September evening, and I'm driving around the town square of Oxford, Mississippi, in a rented car, in search of the hotel I'm staying in for the tonight. Strapped into the back seat of the small Chevrolet is an even smaller Martin acoustic guitar, a 015. Built in 1955, the year of my birth, it's been my constant companion on a journey that started a few weeks earlier in New York and will end in a couple of months' time in Northern California at the Fretboard Journal Summit. I'm in Oxford to interview Greg Johnson, curator of the extensive blues archive at the University of Mississippi. Affectionately known as Ole Miss, the university campus is just outside what looks to be a very agreeable town. Unlike almost all the other places I've visited so far in Mississippi, it seems both prosperous and very white. The town buildings are ornate and well-maintained. There are smart boutiques and pleasant coffee shops around a nice town square. The white courthouse building and the white clock tower are all so charming they might have been transplanted from a prim East Coast town. In 1962, the 21-year-old Dylan had written Oxford Town in response to a request from Broadside, a highly influential, often controversial folk revival magazine. It had issued a challenge to all songwriters to submit a song about what it saw as the issue of the moment, the riot at the University of Mississippi over the admission of its first black student, James Meredith. There are some memorable photographs of Meredith being escorted by FBI agents onto the campus. Numerous books have been written about and around the events of that October day in Mississippi. But Dylan's simple folk song, using only two chords on an acoustic guitar, did more than just report the story. Dylan used simple poetry and the unique power of popular song to get me involved in what was happening, to make me both understand and feel. He went down to Oxford Town, guns and clubs followed him down, all because his face was brown, better get away from Oxford Town. I was standing in the place where those events played out almost 5 decades after I first heard the song, back in Dagenham, a suburb of East London, sitting in the shadow of the Ford factory, the freewheeling Bob Dylan LP had been on constant repeat in my bedroom. A teenage me trying to figure out the chords and memorise the words of Oxford Town, the shortest, simplest song on the album. Back then, I'd get to realise that the guitar, in the words of Richard Hoover of the Santa Cruz Guitar Company, was capable of creating a song that brings us coupled together in love, tell a truth that eventually heals a rift between enemies, comforts the sick or perhaps lights a spark that changes the course of history. Remembering that teenage guitar player in that dreary bedroom and Dylan's early song somehow gave my trip through the USA renewed purpose. Retracing the 100-year journey that the acoustic guitar had made from Europe to America and back again had started as a personal inquiry into the history of the American flat top and guitar obsession, but was now as much about understanding how the guitar became the defining instrument of our age. Chapter 12 is about a third of the way through the book and deals with the 1920s. The birth of jazz, the golden buckle of the cotton belt, and country music's big bang. It's the roaring 20s and the jazz age. Radio spreads the word and creates a new phenomena, nationally recognised music stars, many of whom who take the guitar into the spotlight for the first time. The massive growth in radio has a liberalising effect on the production of white country and black race records. We learn how the guitar, through its portability and fit with simple, popular roots music, becomes America's people's instrument of choice. We travel to Clarksdale, Mississippi, the birthplace of the blues, and its twin, Bristol, in Virginia, the birthplace of white blues, where hillbilly singer Jimmy Rogers, the first pop star, and the Carter family, the first country music stars, invent the three-minute pop song. As a decade comes to a close, in the distance we can hear the first twangs of an electric guitar. This chapter also deals with one of the myths of the music and guitar industry, that of Lloyd Law. And I'll pick up from there. Law, as saviour of Gibson, is an attractive and convenient myth. The gifted maverick who didn't get on with the uncharismatic management. The development of the master tone and master model range in Gibson was almost certainly a team effort. During Law's time at the company, the workforce numbered over 60, and a whole team of people worked in engineering and research. The master model instruments were time-consuming and something of a pain for a high-volume instruments factory like Gibson to produce. Most importantly, they were slow sellers. In fact, Law's period with Gibson was something of a financial fiasco, with the company taking pretty close to insolvency. The refinements that Law and his team introduced in the Style 5 series included violin-style F-holes that replaced the round or oval sound holes of conventionally designed fretted instruments, the scroll body outline, carved backs and tops, and tuned body components. Professional players at the time heard how the louder, more focused sound that F-holes projected was ideally suited to both playing into a microphone and reaching above a big acoustic orchestra's brass section. Maybelle Carter was aware that her signature guitar style, that blend of lead and bass lines, had to cut through in a time before post-production and anything like studio mixing. Whether she realised that the L5 was precisely the right instrument to do justice to her style is unlikely. She primarily had the most expensive guitar that Gibson made at the time because she was a star. But there was no doubt the guitar was the right guitar for her music. There is equally no question that the L5 and Law period instruments are superlative. It was the Law-inspired F5 mandolin that was rediscovered by Bill Monroe in the mid-40s to give him his unique sound. First introduced in 1922, it had a longer neck than standard at the time and a raised fingerboard to accommodate the introduction of F-holes. These features helped the top to better vibrate and improve tone and volume, and Bill Monroe knew it was capable of embracing his new style of bluegrass music. Such was the success of his sound in the late 40s and 50s, bluegrass players began actively searching out Law-labelled and post-Law so-called Fern F5 mandolins. Their improved projection, longer necks and a distinctive bark enabled players to reach more muted chop chords, thereby emulating both Monroe's sound and style of playing. By the 1960s and 70s, F5s were considered legendary by a new generation of bluegrass players. In 1969, pre-war Gibson F5s sold for around about $1,500, triple the price of the equally legendary pre-war Herringbone D28 guitar. They also reached the notice of instrument collectors and speculators, and by the 1970s, the very best examples were selling for $100,000. In 2004, the Country Music Hall of Fame also acquired Maybell's L5 for $575,000, acquiring it from Groom Guitars. While in the early 2007, a couple of Lloyd Law F5s reached $200,000 before the market took a really severe downturn. The last extract comes from Chapter 22, the 1960s in the USA. Tin Pan Alley's gone. I put an end to it. It's a quote from Bob Dylan. We witnessed a juggernaut of white British bands led by the Beatles and how they reflected electric blues back across the Atlantic, almost extinguishing American rock and roll and the American folk revival. We follow the overwhelming impact of the Beatles on US musicians and musical styles and explore the motivation behind Bob Dylan's betrayal of folk music with his shift from acoustic to electric guitar. We observe the emergence of early Americana by the band and its influence on British folk rock pioneers. And finally, the decade of war, peace and love that culminates with Woodstock, producing an anthem that carries across into the 70s. This extract is from midway through Chapter 22. I'm not going to answer any questions as to my association, my philosophical or religious beliefs, or my political beliefs, or how I voted in any election, or any of these private affairs. I think these are very improper questions for any American to be asked, especially under such compulsion as this. I'd be very glad to tell you my life story if you want to hear it. The quote is from Pete Seeger, August the 18th in 1955, addressing the House on American Activities Committee. Declining his repeated offers to tell the committee about his life and the songs he sung, Seeger was ultimately and unsurprisingly indicted for contempt of Congress. Subsequently sentenced to 10 one-year terms in prison to run simultaneously, he never actually served time, but did have to keep the federal government informed any time he left his district of New York. Although he successfully appealed his case in a fight that lasted until 1962, he was, as a consequence of his contempt, often banned from playing events unless he signed an oath that he would not use his performance to, quote, promote communism or overthrow the government. Who would have thought that a single man and a guitar could be so threateningly powerful? But Seeger was one of the very few activist singers who genuinely suffered for using song to preach about civil and workers' rights, racial and religious equality, internal understanding, and anti-militarism. Perhaps what most offended Seeger about Dylan strapping on a Fender Stratocaster at Newport in 1965 wasn't just the noise, rendering his lyrics inaudible, but that he seemed to be using his freedom of speech not to protest, persuade, or preach, but purely to excite and entertain. It's easy with a hindsight of history to know that Dylan was not deserting the cause, but at the time it must have looked like betrayal to Seeger. In the USA of the mid-1960s, McCarthy was long gone, so Dylan had little to fear, whatever he sang about. But around the world, protest singers with guitars continue to play an important part in an unarmed struggle against despots and dictators. They realise that they might not change the world, but maybe their words and songs might shed a little light into the dark places where oppression and injustice lie. There's a famous Joan Baez quote. People say music changes the world, but the guitar, of all the instruments, is played everywhere. Under every dictatorship, there is some dilapidated guitar and the local version of blowing in the wind. The guitar in these countries have been the most wretched things, but they've served their purpose of uniting people. Meanwhile, in the relative sanity of Abbey Road Studios, and as Dylan was infuriating fans as he went electric, Paul McCartney was rather perversely recording the completely acoustic Yesterday, serving to further underline the latent power of the acoustic guitar in a world now largely dominated by the electric. Surprisingly, Yesterday, written solely by McCartney and recorded on an Epiphone Texan flat top lent to him by producer George Martin, that song is financially the Beatles' most successful tune, although primarily because of its over 2,000 cover versions. McCartney's other major self-penned acoustic song, the civil rights commentary Blackbird, recorded a few years later on his own Martin D28, is also in the top 10 of the Beatles' most financially lucrative songs. But it's entirely wrong to label either of these McCartney-penned compositions and performances as by the Beatles. Yesterday had been kicking around Abbey Road for many months before it was finally recorded with just McCartney in the studio. The group, and of course the ever-truculent Lennon in particular, were annoyed that the song was even being proposed as a Beatles song. Like Blackbird and Yesterday, it belongs to a genre of highly personal songs performed by their composers, categorised in record stores by the 1970s as singer-songwriter. But many earlier artists, from Blind Lemon Jefferson and Leb Belly, through Jimmy Rogers and Hank Williams, to Josh White and Woody Guthrie, and ultimately Dylan himself, had each explored songs where complex imagery and veiled metaphor hid real-life events or the writer's true emotions. Regardless of era, it was a concept that was inextricably linked to the acoustic guitar. It was, in fact, a genre that was only possible with the acoustic guitar, and one that, while rooted in folk music, only truly came of age in the following decade. But before the singer-songwriter generation would have their decade in the sun, in both Britain and the USA, folk traditionalists were wringing their hands at the way modern progressive folkies were torturing the authentic canon of their source material. What was being created were modern electric takes on traditional songs, as well as original compositions that often sounded like adaptations of something written 100 years earlier. In America, Dylan's touring band, The Hawks, had in 1968 officially metamorphosed into the band and created a genre that by the late 1990s would be known as Americana. At the time, what they were playing was closer to the eclectic, roots-orientated music pioneered by guitarist John Fahey that he'd christened American Primitive. The songs on The Band, the group's second album, although conceived that year in upstate New York, formed a concept album that talked to older, rural themes, the harvest, slavery, and the Civil War. From the studiously rough-and-ready album cover photo, mimicking the daguerreotype Civil War photography of Matthew Brady, to the tack piano, accordion, jaws harp, and loose trombone in the instrumentation, the album was folk rock's Sgt. Pepper, albeit one that sounded like a musical message in a bottle from an earlier time. The songs that made up The Band were largely written in the hippie rural ideal of Woodstock, where Hendrix and Van Morrison were fellow residents, and is, confusingly, many miles from Bethel, where the Woodstock Festival was finally held. Robbie Robertson, who wrote most of the songs and shared engineering credits, was looking for the sort of woody thuddy sound that was usually associated with a dark basement studio or a wood shack halfway up an Appalachian mountain. Intentionally mimicking the basement tape sound of the Big Pink House that the band's first album had been recorded in, the recording equipment was installed in Sammy Davis Jr.'s pool house, attached to his old Hollywood mansion off Sunset Boulevard. The studio setup was lo-fi, acoustic and unplugged, 40 years before those terms, and the hot valve analog technology popularised by Jack White and the White Stripes was once again all the rage. The album's influence has been long, wide and deep, affecting everything from early British folk rock to new wave and punk. Elvis Costello, hearing The Band for the first time, recalled, "It was like receiving a letter from the other side of the world, a world where you couldn't possibly understand, let alone visit. It was only later, when you ever knew a bit about Hank Williams and Bessie Smith, that that you started to fill in the blanks. It was pretty instantly affecting a new band, then practicing in a suburban North London living room, a musical collective who pretty much invented the British version of Americana, electric folk rock. That band was Fairport Convention.